bring your flyers or bring your posters or something to the neighborhood, and some criminal group members that are at the perimeter of the community wave some guns in your face and say, no, you can't come in here, this territory is taken. I think that would be pretty persuasive. And most politicians that aren't in the deal striking mood would say, like, okay, you know, put their hands up and start walking away and say, okay, like, sorry, I got it. The result of that is that they're going to be not banned, you know, nothing formal, not banned, not prohibited, but it's going to be relatively a lot more challenging for them to get their name out.
This is the Way Podcast.
The militias needed to have a heads up that I was coming.
I personally think that, like in chess.
So that's how deep the addiction goes.
I've been incarcerated most of my life.
Having a conversation with
Bill. They've been given no option, either join or die.
Snipers, and it was a military.
J. Cole came and hung out most of the choir session. I'm standing at the studio glass looking out into the studio.
If you want to know more about The Way Podcast, go to podcasttheway.com.
This is Bill with The Way Podcast on FM 91.7, WHUS Doors at the top of the hour, and also on 90.3 WRIU South Kingston at the top of the hour. Today, I'll be talking with Jessie Bullock. She is a PhD student in the Department of Government, where she studies comparative politics and political economy with substantive interests in urban development, large-scale corruption, organized crime, and bureaucracy. In particular, she wrote a dissertation called Machine Gun Politics, Why Politicians Cooperate with Criminal Groups. So today, we're going to be talking about that. Be sure to give a 5-star rating, review, like, share the show. Every little bit helps. You can find more information at podcasttheway.com. Again, that's podcasttheway.com. What is your research? What is it focused on?
Sure. My research is about organized crime in politics. And specifically, I focus on the types of electoral deals that criminal groups and politicians strike with each other in order to help politicians get elected, and criminal groups to mobilize the people that live in their communities to go to the ballot box and vote for their chosen candidate.
Where in particular, what countries or what areas?
Most of my work is in Latin America. Specifically, I've done the bulk of the work in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil.
Gotcha. I upload some of the content on Reddit. I found that to be, along with Twitter, Instagram, all the common social medias. And I covered Central America a few times, and I hate that I seem to always dive into the negatives. And one person even commented saying, we have beautiful countries, don't just address the news topics. But every episode, like today too, I feel like I'm always looking at the negative side of things.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that's one reason why, as researchers, we're drawn to studying problems, because when there's something that's good that you can talk about how great it is, but to try and put an optimistic spin on this, drawn to the negative things, it's because we want to make it better, or it's because it's a problem that one hypothetical researcher, policymaker, anybody is trying to fix, not merely just pat themselves on the back for.
Yeah, a good pat on the back, oh, look, I addressed it. I want to ask you how to fix it, but I kind of want to save that till the end, because first I want to address the problem. But seeing as this is a continuous problem with the region, how long has this historically been happening? How long have these politicians been corrupt and bribed and bought out?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I think corruption is about as old as human history. So far longer than I have been studying it, or than really any of their current systems of government are in place. I think it kind of waxes and wanes depending on how permissible society is, the different forms of government. You know, I'm not necessarily saying that this is an indictment on democracy or authoritarianism in one way or the other, but the more autocratic crackdown types of authoritarian regimes might make this type of behavior harder to get away with. Of course, pros and cons to any types of levels of like liberties in society, let's say. But to get into a little bit more detail in the case at hand, these large scale criminal organizations in Brazil, in Rio de Janeiro that I'm studying, they weren't even really around until the 1970s, the 1980s. And okay. They only really got large scale access to arms a little bit later in like the 90s, let's say. So part of it is correlated with like the growth and the military capacity and the ability to use violence of some of these criminal groups. So a couple decades long practice, but of course, like to use a really old example of, let's say, like the origins of the Sicilian Mafia. The Sicilian Mafia used to be cattle rustlers. And they were farmers, and they were like protecting in air quotes, you know, protecting slash extorting. Yeah. You could imagine that in the favelas of Rio de Janeiro, where there's some drug traffickers that have, or militia members that have Uzis and AK-47s, that like it presents a politician or a voter with a different type of choice than still a formidable, scary early day mafia, but that has a knife. So like the level of violence and the level of intimidations has certainly changed over time, even if this is an ancient practice.
Would you say it's gotten worse in terms? Like, yeah, we have higher caliber weapons, but are people more willing to torture to farther extremes, stuff like that?
I mean, worse is a hard question to answer. Of course, violence with organized crime certainly has gotten worse over time. But I think that that's, you know, that's kind of veering further afield from the specifics of the research that I do. But that's more of a broader commentary on the way that the war on drugs is going and the strategies that government is using to fight some of these criminal groups, which we can pretty clearly see now haven't been that effective. But I think to try and answer the question in good faith, I think it's more the case that just politicians are getting smarter about learning how to use these strategies. And this is kind of becoming a learned practice of how to make these protect themselves while making negotiations with criminal groups that do keep them safe.
Part of that,
and help them get what they want electorally.
Yeah, and part of that, I saw you interview 37 candidates, and all of them said that clientelism, it was a widespread phenomenon.
Yeah, so like this is my concept, criminal clientelism, that's referring to the behavior when politicians make electoral deals with criminal organizations. So generally votes are on the line, and the politician that is hoping to get these votes will offer, you know, bribes, favors, a variety of types of longer or short-term benefits to the criminal organization in order to get their help delivering votes on election day. And of course, since it's my concept that I am explaining and writing about in this paper, it's not like the candidates said, oh yeah, like criminal clientelism is happening here. But they were describing the same phenomenon, and like there wasn't a word for it. And over time, through more and more of these conversations, I kind of started noticing that they were talking about the same thing and that they had a lot of shared experiences. But it's not the type of thing that's talked about that openly, because no one wants to say that they were that guy that was striking deals with criminal organizations.
Yeah, I mean, I want to say that would tank your career. Can these cartel or can these organizations do such a good job that even if you reveal that, hey, I'm working with them, it doesn't matter, you'll still win?
I think that's possible in other contexts. I think that, you know, I brought up the mafia, I brought up Italy later. I think Italy in a more historic context, I think that Mexico, some Central American countries, that it is the case that some of the cartels are so powerful that even if one owns up to it, there's not a lot that others can do. What we see happening in Brazil is a little different.
Not to get political, and I always hate being political, but a very high politician in America confesses something and he still almost won an election. So I don't doubt it.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, I should preface that by saying that the types of organized crime I'm talking about are the types of that are like street gangs, drug trafficking organizations, extortion and protection rackets that operate in residential areas and that control territory. I'm not even, my work is not really inclusive in scope of white collar crime type of extortion rackets, which is a whole nother ball game of connections between organized crime and politics.
I bet.
But so what I think is happening in Brazil is something that is a little bit different though, where it's not necessarily that there's these all-powerful criminal organizations. They're actually quite, at least politically and in terms of society, they're specifically in Rio. It's a little bit different case in São Paulo, but the ones that I'm studying in Rio are kind of disorganized and decentralized. So they're not these, there's not like one all-powerful Al Capone style figure. But they're this loose confederation of many, many, many franchises almost that are operating in the favelas and in informal settlements across the state of Rio. But it's more the case that the practice is so widespread that it's kind of like, even if it were to come out that a politician were to do it, they would have a pretty convincing excuse of just like, this is what everyone does. Like, why am I the one that's getting in trouble? This is something that's so widespread, even if not widely discussed, that like, I'm not exceptional for doing this. This is just the way that business is done here. So, and that's not to say either that all politicians are elected from this, but merely that it's a larger size than just like one bad apple that's doing this practice.
It's hard to give an actual percentage because I feel like most politicians don't want to reveal it. But like, what percent do you think of politicians are actually doing this practice?
It's really tough. I've still been struggling with the question. I don't really know, actually. I'm doing some follow-up research focused more on the politician side that hopefully I'll be able to answer this soon. What I will say is there's about... estimates vary, but there's about a third to half of residents of the municipality of Rio that live under criminal control. So certainly not all of them are susceptible to the demands of whatever the criminal organization wants, but a lot are. So if you think about like the potential pool of voters, that's a lot of votes, a third to a half. If you strike enough deals or if you make just one deal, but with someone that has influence over a lot of people, that could be decisive in terms of whether or not you win the election or not.
I feel like the statistic's wrong because I've heard it through rumors, but I want to say something like 10% of Americans vote. So the entire country is something small like that. If you get that 33% to vote in Rio, you already sort of have the majority of the percentage than even we do.
Yeah, you know, and I'm really glad you bring this up too, because this is important for thinking about measurement of the question in Brazil, because voting is mandatory. So your viewers would be shocked to see the turnout proportions in Brazil compared to the United States, average between like 70 to 80% turnout in elections. It's really, really quite high. But again, voting is compulsory. So 70 to 80% isn't 100%. It's not perfect compliance, but it's a lot greater than we see there than we see here. And this conversation is actually a bit boring to get into like the nitty gritty of the electoral rules and the way that the specific way that legislative candidates can get elected. So I'll bracket that for later if you don't want to get into that. But But I'll just leave it at saying that the legislative races in particular are incredibly competitive. There's a lot of people that enter the electoral playing field. So despite turnout being really, really high, the races are still super competitive. So like for a lot of people, one neighborhood could make or break whether or not they win.
Wow. That's actually wild. In terms of the percent turnout, I remember I did an episode on Rwanda not too long ago, and their president, prime minister slash dictator, he got like, I want to say like 98 or like 100% of the votes. And just to give you an idea of how corrupt that election was, but some of that nitty gritty or some of that technical stuff. Yeah. What's a little bit of it? I mean, it's good to know how it actually works.
Sure. Yeah. So their electoral system is called an open list PR, proportional representation. And what that means is that that for a legislative race, each party will have a list of candidates that are running for that specific seat. And there's open list and there's closed list. And open list means that whoever's the candidate from that party, let's say, like as a simplifying assumption, let's say we're talking about the United States and we're talking about Democrats, Republicans, and the Green Party, just to make it three parties so that it approximates the Brazil situation a little bit better. In an open list system, the winningest Democrat will be the one that gets the most votes. And that will likely be the person that's elected for the Democratic Party in that race if they get enough, assuming that they get enough votes to elect one person or more. Okay. In a closed list system, this is where the party makes the list. So even if one candidate gets the most votes, but they're not the first person on the list, that doesn't necessarily mean that they'll get into, it doesn't necessarily mean that they'll get elected. So closed list versus open list, like the important fact to remember is that the party has control over what the order in line and what the rank of the candidates is. In open list, it just means whoever gets the most votes gets in. So Brazil has this open list system where it's about which candidates get in, making the parties a little bit less important. And like, here's the big twist that makes it very different from the United States. There's about 30 political parties that are competing in every electoral cycle. So we have a ton of candidates in per party that are trying to get elected for the legislature, and a ton of parties in the playing field. So in some of the elections that I'm looking at in Rio, we have, I'm not exaggerating, this is not hyperbole, we have about 1,500 candidates that are trying to get elected for 51 seats. So
good for them.
Could you imagine an electoral race where there's 1,500 people to choose from? It's impossible.
Most Americans don't even research one candidate, let alone 1,500.
Yeah. Well, I don't think that Brazilians research all 15 either, to be sure. And there's some that are in there that are, you know, like running as a joke, or they have like so few resources that they're not able to campaign outside of, you know, maybe like the small confines of their neighborhood. So there's plenty of candidates that actually don't end up getting many votes, because how could you with 1,499 to compete with?
And sorry to cut it off a bit, but of those 1,500, I feel like if you're one of the candidates that goes to a criminal group, you kind of win, since they have 33% control and it's such a spread out playing field. Doesn't that sort of guarantee you a top, I don't know, 20 or something?
Well, I mean, that is part of my hypothesis, is that because the playing field is so segmented, if you have the resources and let's say, you know, like the bravery or whatever cognitive impulse it is that makes you think that it's a good idea, let's say like impunity, then that it really can help push someone that's on the margin, but the underside of it, above the margin, to being a decisive victory.
Gotcha. All right, I cut you off a bit when you were explaining like the close and open. Was there anything else to understand about how the government works?
You know, I think that's like the headline for how the electoral system is. It's important to remember the rules, that it's this, that it's not just like the way our elections work in the United States. It's what's called first past the post, where it's just whoever gets the most wins, and that's that. But it is organized by the political parties, and they have 30 plus parties. So we just, every single election cycle, we see this proliferation of tons of parties and tons of candidates that makes it really burdensome for the voter to try and figure out who they're aligned with. So a lot of it becomes super localized and geographic of like, who's the candidate for my neighborhood, or who's the one that has hosted the most events that talks about the improvements they're going to be making for issues that I care about or the place that I live. And it, even though the system isn't structured as such, the way that the campaigns have defaulted has turned into this hyper-localized phenomenon that allows the criminal groups to have this level of influence.
And in terms of how these criminal groups actually get the politician votes, with such a spread out party system, I saw one of your, one of the things your research found was gatekeeping. Was how they go about it. And I feel like if there's so many candidates, gatekeeping is kind of easy for these criminals, because it's already hard enough for these people voting to figure out who to vote for as it is.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. So gatekeeping is this process that I'm describing, where, going back to our earlier part of the conversation, where criminal groups can leverage, you know, one of the tools that they use for their criminal business. It's not about politics at all, but it's about their access to violence and the control of the communities that they live in. So they can decide effectively which candidates are going to be able to campaign in their neighborhoods and which ones aren't. You could imagine, if you try to put yourself in the shoes of, let's say, not an enterprising, calculating politician that's trying to strike this deal, but just a normal guy that wants to run his campaign in this community, and you and your team, you know, bring your flyers or bring your posters or something to the neighborhood, and some criminal group members that are at the perimeter of the community wave some guns in your face and say, "No, you can't come in here. This territory is taken." I think that would be pretty persuasive. Yeah. And most politicians that aren't in the deal striking mood would say, like, okay, you know, put their hands up and say, and start walking away and say, okay, like, sorry, I got it. And the result of that is that they're going to be not banned, you know, nothing formal, not banned, not prohibited, but it's going to be relatively a lot more challenging for them to get their name out to voters in this community, and to, they're going to have to be a lot more creative in the ways that voters in this community might hear about them. So criminal organizations kind of effectively become, they go like pruning off candidates one by one by banning access or restricting access to only their preferred candidate, giving them safe passage, but not letting anybody else access voters and give their information to voters during the campaign period.
And I feel like that's easy enough to do, where if somebody's at the border or even in the town, if you have the right person walk up and like threaten the right way, as the remaining 99.999% of the population will have no idea about it, because that could happen two streets from over where I am, and I would have no idea about that, and I'd have no idea that that politician is a good one and the other one's corrupt.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And you know, a question that I often get when talking about this concept too is like, well, okay, but you're talking about literally going into a community and having a physical barbecue or having a physical, putting posters up, but what about social media? Like this, if we think about, especially with the elections that we just had in 2020, like if we think about social media and the internet, there's no reason why political campaigns should be constrained to in-person stuff only. But I've even seen and done interviews with people where they've told me that the criminal group members police the neighborhood Facebook pages or the neighborhood other types of social media pages. And if someone makes a post for a candidate that they don't support, then they ask them to take it down, or they try to preempt the situation at the beginning by saying, you know, only campaign propaganda for John Doe is allowed in this Facebook group.
Do they message the person or go to the person's house?
You know, I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if they would do a little bit of both.
Yeah, addresses don't seem to be that hard to find on social media.
Mm-hmm.
Creepily mm-hmm. enough, that's a whole nother segment.
Yeah, I'll add this to my list of follow-up questions.
Sounds good. And so that's like gatekeeping. They shun out. Side note too, social media, if you catch them in the act of like gatekeeping, like if you see a politician getting turned away and somebody takes out their phone and able to record it, I could see that sort of being detrimental. Like if it gets out on YouTube and people's Facebooks, I get they police the social media side of things, but if done right, that could sort of turn back on them.
Yeah. I mean, I think again, like this, I'm skeptical that it would. I think in like you're saying this from a perspective of, and I think this too, like if this is something that you saw in your neighborhood, or if this is something that I saw in my neighborhood. But I think that it's so quotidian in the specific context that I'm studying, maybe not even like talking about our neighborhoods in the United States, but just like, you know, the way that criminal groups interact with voters and with politicians is super different in Mexico than it is in Brazil. So maybe it would even be the type of thing that it would seem exceptional and really strange there. And I keep saying Brazil, but also like, I mean, the even more specific context of Rio. But I've come to believe that the practice is, it really is so quotidian that it wouldn't attract as much attention as you might expect, just because people have kind of become inured to it and are learning how to live with it and learning how to like ignore it or protect themselves and stay safe. And that's the priority.
For people, it's sort of like breathing air. It's like common knowledge. The way we see in America politicians as being bought out and allow them to have these brand names backing them and funding them in these areas, the people just, they don't even like almost care in a way. It's just so commonplace that it doesn't change much. Are they trying to retaliate or anything?
I think they do care, but I think that there's a lot of unsatisfactory options for the what do you do about it question. So as an important point of background, you know, Brazil has had a really tough time in the last couple of decades with corruption scandals, with trust in politicians. This is not about organized crime at all, but just in general across the board. Brazilians are really dissatisfied with government, and they've kind of hopped from one at the federal level from like one corruption scandal to the next. And some of this has been meted out by politicians that implement even worse policies in order to fix said corruption. So people are really jaded, and they're really, really cynical about politicians writ large. So I think that even thinking about like what the available alternatives are, this is something that becomes relevant where there's like, it's not like they're being forced to vote for the criminal group's candidate versus like their favorite dream candidate that they always wanted to vote for. I think a lot of them view the situation as like, well, they're all bad, so why don't I not upset the criminal group and protect myself and make sure that I'm not going to get hurt and protect my family by voting for theirs, because they're all bad. So what's the harm? So I think that that's kind of like the mental model of a lot of people in this situation. that do choose to vote for criminal groups. As an interesting side note, even though I mentioned that voting is mandatory, there's the option at the polling station to cancel your, to spoil your ballot, which is like, it's just a button you press that throws your ballot away. Interestingly, you still have to show up. You're still required to show up, but you can eliminate yourself from the pool of eligible voters if you so choose. And this, this is high. You know, it's double digit percentages of people that choose to do this, to just eliminate themselves from the pool of eligible voters as kind of a protest vote. So I think that this is kind of the safer, in terms of physical safety, the safer move for a lot of people that live in favelas that are just not just frustrated with criminal groups and politicians, but just frustrated with politics, period.
Gotcha. And there's like the gatekeeping side we address. Is this the other side? Is this the corralling that criminal groups are doing to, you know, like threaten the population? Like, hey, you better vote for this politician.
Yeah. So I think that honestly, like the bar is a little bit lower for gatekeeping if we're thinking about criminal organization sophistications and their political preferences. It doesn't take much for them to be gatekeeping because they already have the weapons. They already control territory. This is just more of what they do regularly day to day, and of letting some candidates in and not letting others in. This might be the same as, you know, people that are their customers or that are their business partners, or monitoring to make sure the police don't come in and raid their community or something like that. Yeah. But when we turn to corralling, which is more of a voter-centric relation, I think that the criminal organizations have to either, you know, care a little bit more. They have to have the right financial or policy incentive to do this at a little bit higher level than they do just for gatekeeping. And corralling is like, in political science, we call it as like brokerage, or, you know, mobilizing voters. Those are the types of behaviors that we'll see when they're corralling. And I suppose if like you're thinking about the horse, or like the agricultural term for corralling, then it's similar to that as well, of just like rounding people up and sending them to a specific place. And that is the polling place. So I propose that they can use coercion, you know, they can use force, their weapons, their threats, even if they're not acting on them. Still, we know that criminal organizations can be really scary and really threatening. So they don't even have to beat someone up in order to effectively send someone to the polling station. They just have to threaten it. Or they can use persuasion. And this could be, let's say, like garden variety vote buying, regular vote buying that we hear about in communities that are not dominated by criminal groups, or that we see in the movies of people selling their vote. Or more, this kind of builds off of the idea of real deep-rooted cynicism and disillusionment in politics, of genuinely convincing people in their community that their candidate is going to be the best one. Thread that I haven't shared much yet about the context in Rio de Janeiro is that a lot of these favelas that are dominated by drug traffickers are places that have been deeply excluded from the state and that the state has neglected for decades. So there's some animosity and lack of distrust between residents in these communities and the government too. So it could be that criminal organizations, they say, you know, our candidate will be the one that looks out for you, that has your back in city council. And why would you think that another candidate does? Because all they've done for all of these decades is exclude us and make development or stymie any type of progress towards development. So it could be that there really is some genuine persuasion going on as well. And regardless of the path, if it's a little bit of coercion, persuasion, maybe both at the same time, the outcome is that we'll see more people going to the polling station, you know, likely like pressing whatever button behind closed doors that is for the criminal group's chosen candidate too.
Sometimes, yeah, most bare bones, generic, simple technique could work too. In America, we have our flaws. The other day I was talking with a friend of mine and we're saying, our media is just as bad as Russia. It's horrible. And I'm like, well, I did an episode on Russia's media not too long ago and our media is flawed. It is bad. But Russia, you post something that doesn't even sound bad and you are banned. You can't even upload on social media without putting these big 200 character tags. And if you go far enough, like if you talk about Putin's daughters, for example, you're completely banned. You're not a journalist anymore. So There's situations like that. And our politicians are like corrupt, but nobody seems to like any politician really. But then I hear stuff like this, and I mean, we have like no hope in our candidates, we feel like, but down there, they must really not have any hope. Just if you have all these candidates that are bought out, and even the criminal groups themselves are saying, hey, vote for us. And you're like, okay, sure, I'll trust you, the criminal group. I might as well. What else am I going to do?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to make it sound like there's like this is the only way that politics is done, or that these are the only way that candidates get elected in Brazil. Certainly not. There's some, like these tend to be the more superstar candidates or the ones that like win by a landslide. They're not the ones that are fighting for like one, bumping up one neighborhood than the next. But there certainly are some candidates that win by like these more traditional types of policy appeals that you might see in the United States, or that are like more recognizable and you could place on like a left to right spectrum. But like the municipality of Rio de Janeiro and the state of Rio de Janeiro, they are at a time where criminal groups are influential over a larger number of voters than they have been in the past. And I don't know if it's because of that, or if it, like I said, you know, it's just been like a rough couple of decades, especially in recent years at the national level for Brazilian politics that have made some people disillusioned. But I have a lot of friends in Brazil that I think are really apprehensive, and that even though they might not live amongst criminal organizations, they're finding it hard to find hope going forward too. So it's a challenging moment in Brazilian politics.
I believe it. And one part you said that was interesting was sometimes they would pay people. So like that just surprised me in general, and the amount of people you have to pay out. How much money are they receiving to even be okay paying out and still make a profit? Like how much do these politicians pay these criminal groups?
Yeah, I mean, I wish that I had like a census of this. I would love to really try and peel the curtain back on some of these figures. Most of the dollar amounts that I've heard have been through one-on-one interviews that, you know, someone might be like charitable enough to offer up a number. And from what I understand there, this also has a really, really wide range. So some of the more sophisticated criminal organizations, sophisticated in terms of their gatekeeping and corralling abilities, of their ability to mobilize voters, these I've heard are more likely to be the protection racket, extortion militias, which are kind of started off as like off-duty police officers or ex-police or ex-military extortion and execution rackets. But a lot of these, some of the figures that I've heard from militia organizations that mobilize voters for their candidates are tens of thousands of reais, the Brazilian currency. Right now it's like about 5 to 1 to the dollar, but tens of thousands of reais for entry into the community. So for safe passage and privileged entry. And then some of them have all of these add-ons as additional packages that they sell, like a bundle. So you can hire some of their gang members for the entire duration of the campaign period for 30 days for a couple of weeks at different price thresholds in order to campaign, go around, knock door to door for you. You can hire not a specific people, but you can hire them to you can rent out their time instead of labor, where you can buy a barbecue or a dance party that they'll host on some, you know, Saturday during the campaign period. So the most, air quotes again, sophisticated of all of these types of criminal organizations during the campaign period has a very long menu of things that are available to purchase for the candidate that wants to strike the deal with them. And they claim to deliver. And then, like, on the other side of the spectrum, there's some criminal organizations that don't really want to get involved. And I would imagine that this is also for a variety of reasons. Maybe it's because they're just, you know, busy doing their other business. Maybe they're busy selling drugs and they don't think that it'll be profitable to pull a vendor off of a street corner and do campaign stuff. They think that he might make more money selling drugs, so they'll leave him on the corner, let's say. Or they just don't have the expertise. Like, I think there could be a variety of reasons. Maybe they don't trust the politician after all this that I just said about how people are really cynical. Yeah. This could be the criminal groups too, you know. But for whatever reason,
when the criminal groups don't trust you, you're a bad politician.
Yeah. And, you know, I have heard this, though. I have heard that in some of my interviews, they're like, oh, yeah, no, we expect to never hear from them again. We'll deliver our votes. And then they'll throw out the SIM card in their cell phone and get a new one so that we can never contact them again. But for some of these candidates or for some of these criminal groups that are like, they might want to make a little bit of money during the campaign period. So they'll gatekeep and let someone in and then obstruct access to the others. But they want to be relatively hands off. They will sell privileged access to their communities for as low as 5,000 reais, which with a 5-to-1 currency or exchange rate now is only about $1,000. So. Yeah. In the grand scheme of campaign expenses, that's really not a lot of money.
Yeah. In my head, I'm picturing like them giving out a menu or like a car wash where you have like this tier gets you this, this tier gets you this. You can get the maximum super deluxe package where we'll go to the politician's house and threaten them right at the door, like some crazy stuff.
You know, I haven't seen that, but I will certainly try to take a photo if I do. That would probably be the cover photo for the book if I could get an image like that.
That would be absolutely perfect. Oh, are you working on a book right now?
I am. Yeah, I'm working on a book on this topic. Corralling and gatekeeping are going to be a part of it. Also, some of the stuff that's in progress now is specifically more focused on the politicians. Why do politicians want to do this? What types of politicians are more likely to strike these seemingly crazy deals than others? So stay tuned.
Sounds good. Once you have it all done, send me an email. I can put in the book section too.
Certainly. Yeah.
And in terms of the money, where are the politicians even getting the money to pay these criminals?
So, I mean, I think that it can come from
like taxes.
No. Well, I mean, I suppose I shouldn't eliminate the possibility for people that are already politicians. But a lot of the candidates are trying to get elected for the first time, so they're not already current sitting politicians. I think some of the more successful ones have connections to the private sector, not necessarily like big bank, big corporation, private sector, but let's say really successful neighborhood businesses. They might have some campaign funds from a tire store or from a local auto shop, things like that, where they can float them a couple thousand reais, and they give money like in a weird way. It's kind of like reinvesting it back in the community through the drug traffickers, even though they'll keep a large share of it. And it's kind of like this complex web of mutually scratching each other's backs between some of these local companies and the criminal organizations and the candidates, if they're able to get elected.
That seems unfortunate, because I'm just picturing some local business owners seeing a politician and wanting to invest, and then that politician goes around and just sort of influences or benefits these criminal groups more, which I would guess most people wouldn't want to happen with their funds. But
I think, you know, and this is also, unfortunately, it's something really, really difficult to collect data on. So a lot of what I'm saying is kind of more like a hunch from a couple interviews, but not data that I've collected systematically. But I think that the companies are aware of what's going on. So I don't think that companies are totally clueless about the way that politics works in some of these communities.
Gotcha. Oh, that's sinister.
Yeah.
A little bit. The politician, they got elected. The criminal group has helped them out. Are they now that they're in power, are they using policies to help out the criminal groups? Or do these criminal groups have them in their pocket where they're like, hey, we would really like you if cops weren't in this area. We would really like it if this law was passed.
You know, this is another area where I'll preface what I'm saying with like the, this is the way that I've observed it to work in Rio de Janeiro, but other contexts, let's say like, again, Mexico, Central America, I think there's a lot more longer term relationships and retribution if a politician doesn't pay up or doesn't pay up in terms of policy favors and in terms of like maintaining a good relationship with them for a longer term. But in Rio, a lot of these transactions, especially the ones that I mentioned that are kind of like a more hands-off arm's length transaction where it's like $5,000 to enter the community, you know, run your campaign as you wish, but we won't get involved. From what I understand, there's no expectations on the part of the criminal group. If the candidate gets elected, they expect to never hear from them again. It was an easy way to make $5,000 and that was that. And they expect that the politician is going to act like they have never heard of their name before, or they have no idea who the criminal group members are in a certain community. There's some better documented evidence about the militias that these relationships can be a longer term. And there's even some evidence of militia members running for office. A lot of them have gotten caught and gone to jail. But I think that these types of criminal groups are more likely to have more well-developed policy relationships and policy preferences with the candidates that they elect.
So, yeah, you interviewed people down in the region, down the area. Was there anything real noticeable or real shocking that came out of these interviews?
I think, you know, something that always shocked me was whether I was talking to a criminal group member or a candidate. It was just that people, like, I didn't have to pry the information out of them. People talked about this pretty freely. And it wasn't like, hey, let me clue you in on this crazy thing that's going on. They just talked about it in a way where they were acknowledging that, like, this is something pretty widespread. And, you know, I wish it weren't this way, but this is the way that it is. So I did like everyone else does, and I partook in this. And like really matter of fact like that was, you know, that was several years ago, but I think it was something that really encouraged me to kind of see the project out to conclusion, just because I had a feeling during these conversations that if people were talking about it, not as this like crazy sinister thing, but that just something about the way that it works, that it must be a lot more widespread than we had known before.
Yeah. Were there any stories that stood out, or any like people in particular that said something that really shocked you?
Probably the ones that were the most shocking were the interviews that I did with candidates or with politicians, not candidates anymore, in their offices at work. And they, again, they weren't talking about, like, they weren't acting like they were confessing to a crime, saying, I bribed these drug traffickers and I can't believe I got away with it. But they were just saying, they would tell me about how, you know, like, I grew up in that neighborhood. I don't live there anymore, but I grew up in that neighborhood. And the people that were drug, that are the current criminal organization members, they're children of my friends, or they're children of people that I know. And I, you know, reached out to people in my network and I was able to get access into the community. So it's, a lot of the conversations were kind of like, politicians are politicians, you know, they're like good with words. So a lot of implicit acknowledgement of, getting access or of like deal striking. And then from people in the favelas, people that lived amongst criminal organizations, they were a little bit more real with me about, you know, the goings on of like the throwing out the cell phone chip after getting elected, or talking about like the specific ways that drug traffickers would march people to the polling station on election day morning.
Gotcha. That networking skill is just doesn't have to be 100% legal at times. In terms of the political side and the criminal organization, what about the cops? Are they like, that's sort of the more law side of it. Are they involved? Do they not care? Are they bought out too?
You know, I haven't really gotten too much into this in this conversation about the relationship between the cops and the militias, but it's pretty well documented in journalism and other research that the cops crack down strategically on the drug trafficking organizations, not necessarily the militias, and that they have a more, their relationship is more characterized by reciprocity with the militia style criminal organizations. So the cops certainly have, or it's easier to predict which types of communities are going to feel the wrath of the cops or be cracked down on by the cops, depending on which criminal organization dominates them. And in terms of, you know, going to tie this all together, going back to the conversation about policy favors, one thing that I've heard, even though I still think that the modal response is no favors, is just the one-shot transaction and that's it and done. But one thing that I did hear a lot is that the only type of policy that the criminal organizations wanted if their candidate was elected was to just keep the cops far from their neighborhood. So one legislator, one city councilor doesn't have a ton of power in order to be able to do that. But they might be able to like put their thumb on the scale a little bit. So if the criminal organizations could choose, all they would want is like, don't send the cops in to raid our community. Keep them, yeah. Like, just keep them away.
Nothing crazy. Like, we want these laws passed. Just give us a little buffer. Give us a little leeway.
That's right. That's right. I think, you know, like one outsized crazy example that could be likened to this is Pablo Escobar wanting the extradition laws to be changed. If you've watched Narcos, or if you've like done some reading in your Colombia Medellin cartel history, you'll know that Pablo Escobar was famously downed this airplane full of people as to send a message about extradition. Yeah. About the extradition laws with the United States. But that type of like really crazy, bold, costly signal is for sure going to be the exception rather than the norm in terms of a criminal group advocating for policy preferences.
Yeah, in that case, you're talking about like Pablo Escobar. He's notorious versus common.
It makes for great television, but that should not be expected day to day for criminal groups communicating so loudly and clearly and costly about policy preferences.
Yeah, I'd hope that's not day to day. All right. Well, Dr. Jesse Bullock, thanks so much for coming on the show.
No, it was truly my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me and for your great questions.
Thanks. I'm glad to hear it. And the last question too, is there a final message that you would like to tell the audience?
Oh, gosh. I think that, you know, I guess final message would just be that the project was born from the idea that when we think about criminal organizations, a lot of the conversation is about like bad guys. And then we think about corruption and the conversation is about politicians as bad guys. And I was interested in learning a little bit more about like why the two come together and how it, in some countries that face so many problems related to corruption and violence, kind of how to explain this interaction and how, if we think about the individuals that are in each category, how it can kind of seem like the incentive compatible or the best response for the politicians and the criminal group members respectively, just to try and understand like the how did we get here question. So it was a little long-winded, but like the greater purpose of the project is just understanding how we got here in places that are kind of in this tragic like middle part of the Venn diagram of high violence and high corruption.
And that was Dr. Jesse Bullock. Again, to see her website or see her dissertation, Machine Gun Politics, Why Politicians Cooperate with Criminal Groups, you can go to the description of today's episode. If you're tuning in through the radio, I highly recommend you check out the podcast. It really helps me out. Give a 5-star rating, like, review, share the show. PodcastTheWay.com. Again, that's PodcastTheWay.com. This is FM 91.7. WHUS Stores at the top of the hour, and also FM 90.3 WRIU South Kingston at the top of the hour. And as always, deuces.
This has been The Way Podcast. If you want to know more about The Way Podcast, go to podcasttheway.com. We'll be right back.